First of all, I wanted to thank you for your indulgence throughout this part of the course, which is a little bit constantly evolving and hopefully improving. And of course, a gross hashgarach to Reb Kalman for arranging the Mar Makomos for us. Because things are a little bit evolving, so the information is changing a little bit. So that's which is always a good thing, you know, and updating and changing. But I thank you for your indulgence in that area. In terms of the Chazar Hashi, I really wanted to focus on three stages, which is I guess following the pattern of Rabbi Willig, which is really dealing with issues that present themselves throughout, you know, before a person actually reaches the wedding, and that will be in two parts. You know, the issues of shiduchim and those kinds of puruvu and general issues. Then filling out the ksuba, which Rabbi Willig also recommend it should be done before the wedding, always a good idea. And then we'll get on to the issues of the wedding itself. But in terms of you know, what a person has to reveal, information the person has to reveal in the process of shiduchim. So the Sefer Chafetz Chaim quotes from the Gemara Masechta Chulin that just like when a person is engaging in any transaction, he's supposed to reveal relevant information, otherwise he could run into a problem of a mekach tos or a genevas das. So too in the process of shiduchim, a person is supposed to reveal what is relevant information, and it's not only the two parties themselves, but even a third party who's aware of this information is obligated to reveal it to the relevant parties. And if he doesn't do so, he could be in violation of Lo Yisamra Al Dam Reyecha, preventing your friend from making an ill-advised decision or a mistake. And even if that information was told to you in confidence, or every piece of information Al Pi Halacha is considered to be told to you in confidence, unless you're given a specific directive to reveal that information, confidence is always implied, whether a person is, whatever profession he finds himself in, confidentiality is something that goes throughout Halacha. And all relationships. So everything is always considered to be told in confidence. And nonetheless, a person has an obligation to reveal information, relevant information to parties who are engaged in a shidduch. Of course, if you think that the party is going to reveal it themselves, you as a third party shouldn't stick your nose in. But if you have reason to believe that they might not reveal that information, a third party would be obligated to do so. But what kind of information is a person obligated to reveal? So we will quote it from the Stipler, that a person is only obligated to reveal that kind of information that would subsequently render the Kiddushin a Kiddushei Tos. If the person afterwards finds out about it, then he could legitimately claim that the whole marriage was based upon a mistake, which is a high threat. We will discuss what kind of information could render a Kiddushin a Kiddushei Tos. It can't be that she has a wart on her big toe. It has to be something that would be suspect that a person would never have gone through with the marriage in the first place had they known this piece of information. So that's a pretty high threshold of information that has to be revealed. And according to the Stipler, there are many different situations, scenarios that would not render the Kiddushin and Kiddushei Tos. Subsequently, a person would not be obligated to reveal that kind of information. And even though when it comes to buying and selling a house or any other item, there is a lower threshold. The Stipler argues that's because why should I take a couch that has a tear in it or a car that has a scratch in it? I could always go back to the store and get another car, get another couch. When it comes to shiduchim, the Stipler said it's hard. You know, can't just there's many fish in the sea, but not this kind of fish. You know, you're not necessarily going to find a shidduch that's matim. So therefore, people have a higher tolerance level, and therefore for different issues, and therefore the threshold of information the person be obligated to reveal is also higher. However, Dr. Abraham in the Nishma Safram quotes from Rabbi Yashiv that I think Rabbi Willig has this in the Mordechai, that who has a lower threshold, a lower standard. It's more similar to what we would find in other transactions, in other areas of halach, that a person has to reveal anything that the parties would like to know, not just to deter us nosiness, you know, but they would like to know in terms of making an informed decision. So that kind of information a person is obligated to reveal, even if it doesn't reach the threshold of the Stipler, the render a Kiddushei Tos. And the Chazon Ish is quoted by the, I think we also quotes this in the Mordechai, that that's an Eitz HaTayva. Just in terms of creating Shalom Bayis, because in the future it's never a good idea to, you know, refrain from divulging information that the other party would like to have known before getting married. In fact, the Chazon Ish says, if you don't do so, it could lead to tarumos l'chol achayim. Every time there's a bump in the road, the couple will say, well, you never told me about this, you know, X, Y, or Z. And it could lead to problems down the road. However, yeah.
From Rabbi Eliyashiv, if someone found out about something after they're married, do they need to get remarried?
No, it's not. No, no one's going to say it's going to render it a kiddush etos unless it reaches, you know, one of falls into one of the categories that we will quote from Rav Moshe without going through all of them. There are certain things that render a marriage kiddush etos, and we would assume you never would have gone through with the marriage had you known this. And then there are many items that even if you didn't know, it's not going to make it a kiddush etos. You probably still would have gone through with the marriage. You just would have liked to have known about it. So Rav Yashu says, yeah, that information you have to reveal beforehand so people can make an informed decision. No, no one would say that that's Kiddush HaTos, you don't need to get to things like that. No, and all the marriage, no. But you should have revealed it. And and if you're in the process of Shidduchim, you have an obligation to do so. Yeah.
Information that you would like to know to make an informed decision or need to know to make an informed decision?
That you need to know in order to make an informed decision.
Who determines what you
need? We would like to know everything. In our society, we have a, you know.
who determines what you need to know to make an informed decision?
Yeah, I think that that's...
Meaning, Stam and Nevil said?
People will ask Shilas about what should be revealed and what shouldn't be. What, you know, it doesn't have to be
the average person would.
Correct. I think that's the standard, yeah. But we also made the emphatic point, which is very relevant, which is that you don't have to reveal that information on the resume or even in the first date, you know, or second date, because otherwise people will only see the faults in individuals and not see the positive qualities. So therefore, the Stipler writes that Rav Moshe also has in the Igros Moshe, according to the name of the Chazon Ish as well, that it should be revealed towards the end. As the Chazon Ish said, Likras Hasoif, towards the end. But we would suggest his own personal position, which is that it should be revealed in the, you know, the halfway point, whatever societal norms of that community a person finds himself in, whatever halfway point is, a person should reveal the information towards the halfway point. But if a person is asked a direct question, so then we will also stated that a person should reveal that information. You have no head to lie. If you want to, you know, wiggle your way out of it, you can do that if you know how to do that. But otherwise, you can't present misinformation. Present misinformation is never, you don't have a head to do that. So if the person asks a direct question, you have to either wiggle your way out of it or tell the truth, even if you would not have been obligated to reveal that information independently. Rav Willock felt that part of the job of the Masada Kiddushin is, after, you know, let's say the Shidduch has been made, to meet with a couple to go over certain inyana yuchsin to make sure that this couple is fit to be married. He understood that that's part of the responsibility of the Masada Kiddushin, you know, kind of like the buck stops here to make sure that, you know, that all issues of past yuchsin are addressed prior to getting married. But that fits in with Rabbi Willig's maximalist approach of Seder Kiddushin, that he really feels that all of the issues, or all of the aspects of the marriage come underneath the purview of the Masada Kiddushin, and he should make sure that everything is going as it should. And that fits with the way that he runs his Rabbanus in general. However, sometimes if you don't have the same clout and personality as Rabbi Willig, sometimes, you know, I wouldn't, you know, don't try this at home. It doesn't necessarily work in every community and every Rabbanus, especially if you don't have that same kind of ability to dictate how things should go. But even if you do, Rabbi Bleich felt that this is not the job of the Masada Kiddushin to look underneath every rock and in every, you know, bedikas chametz on the yuchsin of the family, because the Shulchan Aruch tells us simin beis if beis, that based on the Gemara Masechtas Kiddushin, that kol mishpachas becheskes ksheiros hein. And the Beis Shmuel there writes that it's only if it's a mishpacha yedua. However, the Chazon Ish and the Aruch HaShulchan felt even if it's not a mishpacha yedua, the basic assumption is that every mishpacha has a cheskas kashrus, and there's no need for the Masada Kiddushin to start investigating every issue of past yuchsin, other than the couple that's presenting itself, you know, right here and right now. Obviously, if she's a gush and he's a koyin, that's your responsibility. But to start looking into the get of the mother or, you know, or the grandmother is not necessarily the obligation of the Masada Kiddushin, because kol mishpachas becheskas ksheres hen. And in fact, he used to bring a raya, because the Gemara tells us in Masechtas Yevamos, we will mention then the discussion of Eved Va'akum Habo Abbas Yisrael, that the Vlad is considered to be a Vlad Kosher, is a Jewish child. However, it's going to be hard for him to find the Shidduch. So there was one, the son of an Eved Va'akum Habo Abbas Yisrael, who was trying to find the Shidduch. So he came to one of the Amorim, one of the Tanom, and he asked him, am I a Yisrael or not? He told him, of course you are, you can marry any girl you would like. So he said, fine, I'd like to marry your daughter. He said, you know, not a chance. You're not marrying my daughter. So he said, well, who's going to let me marry their daughter? So he said, O gali o nasa bas minach. Either find another daughter, you know, a girl who's the daughter of an Eved Rachma Bobas Israel, or going to Golos. So Rashi explains, what will it help if he goes into Golos? Nobody will know. So says the disciple, how does nobody know? He has to reveal that information. So the disciple says, you see, you don't have to reveal the fact that you're an Eved V'Akma Bo'abas Yisrael. You see, it's only the types of information that will render the Kiddush and Kiddush Shetos. Others argue, no, that is not even relevant information. Because what difference does it really make who a person's parents are? Doesn't matter. The fact that his father is not Jewish will not matter. Will not be of any consequence to the couple. One could argue, all those points. We could deal with the Gemara Masechtas Yevamos independently. However, I have a different kasha, which is, why didn't the Masada Kiddushin ask? So you see that it's not the obligation of the Masada Kiddushin, perhaps it's not the obligation of the Masada Kiddushin to investigate, beyond this couple that's presenting itself in front of you. Because of Rabbi Willig's position, kind of looking at the bigger picture, so he felt that if you have a girl who's a Balas Tshuva, who was on a secular college campus, while she was not religious, doesn't mean that she went to Queens College, she was not religious on a secular college campus, so he felt that there's an assumption that people are engaging in promiscuity, and she probably had relations with a non-Jew. Why should she only be together with Jewish men if she's not religious at all? She probably had relations with a non-Jew, and if she had relations with a non-Jew, then she has halachically the status of a Zayin and would be prohibited from marrying a Kohen. Rabbi Bleich felt that, no, we have the right to assume kol ha'noshim b'cheskes k'sheres hein, and it's not the obligation of the Sadeh Kiddushin to look, in the past and start judging all, Unless he knows information, a red flag, it's not the obligation of the Sadeh Kiddushin to start making these, drawing these conclusions, making these assumptions. Yeah?
Kids in the CS today, wouldn't high school be included in that for Baal
Shuvah? Really? I don't know. Really, that kind of, is that common, like a college campus?
Seems that way, certainly.
I don't know. Even Rabbi Willig, they only said college campuses, yeah.
They don't tell Rabbi Willig everything.
Yeah.
Does this also apply to Shabbat Rochos in terms of how, in terms of if you're making Shabbat Rochos for one day or for 7 days?
We'll get to that in a second. Okay. I mean, towards the end, not a second. Yeah. But yeah. Good. But I'll just tell you, as a younger Masada Kiddushin, it's not as easy as it sounds to start picking apart the family Yuchsin. It's much easier if you would just assume Kol Mishpachas B'cheskes K'sheres Hein. And unless there's a serious red flag, to just deal with the couple that's in front of you. The Rabbi Willig also made an emphatic point that he's never been Masada Kiddushin for a couple who is practicing birth control. So the Gemara tells us, just in terms of a minimal background, the Gemara tells us in Masechtas Yevamos, opinion of Beis Hillel, that in order to fulfill the mitzvah Puravu, a person has to have a zachar and an akeva, a boy and a girl, as the pasuk says, Lo'so baro l'shev sitzer, HaKadosh Baruch Hu didn't create the world to be a vacuum, but in order to be settled, and in order to settle the world, to continue the human race, you have to have a boy and a girl, and that's why Beis Hillel's opinion is that in order to fulfill Puravu, you have to have a boy and a girl. And even after a person has a boy and a girl, so the Gemara tells us himself to Sivamis, based on the Pasuk in Kehelas, but boy kezerah zareach, or orv al tanach yodecha, that there's a mitzvah to continue to have more children above and beyond just the basic minimum of one boy and one girl, but more children. There's a machlekes rishonim, though, how to understand this additional mitzvah of la orv al tanach yodecha. Clearly, Puravu is a regular mitzvah, type of mitzvah we generally encounter, and a very, of course, important mitzvah, and is treated as such. What about one of those mitzvahs? It's one of the mitzvahs, the rare mitzvahs, that we sell a Sefer Torah in order to fulfill the mitzvah approval. However, how should we treat, or how should we view the mitzvah of La'arv al Tanach Yodecha? Is that considered to be like an extension of Puravu? The minimum mitzvah is one boy, one girl, but there's an expanded form of Puravu. Or perhaps it's an entirely different concept, more of a Hidur mitzvah, or perhaps a separate notion entirely of La'arv al Tanach Yodecha. It might have different rules. It might be treated differently and viewed differently than the primary mitzvah of Puravu. So that seems to be a machlokes in the Baal HaMor and the Ramban, which is quoted here in Shulchan Aruch and Simon Aleph Sif Ches, with regards to whether or not we sell a Sefer Torah in order to fulfill V'la Arv al Tanach Yadecha. Puravu, we would. What about V'la Arv al Tanach Yadecha? So one opinion of Rishayim is that we would sell a Sefer Torah for V'la Arv al Tanach Yadecha. It's considered to be an expanded form of Puravu. And the other opinion of Rishayim is we would not sell a Sefer Torah for V'la Arv al Tanach Yadecha. It's an entirely different notion, or perhaps a Hidur mitzvah, but not an expanded form of the basic mitzvah. Because of that, or, you know, as a result of that position of viewing it more as a separate concept or a hidur mitzvah, Sarach HaShulch and the Birka Yosef is diuk in the language of the Rambam that he feels it's this kind of a notion. It's not an expanded form of pruvu, and that's why the Rambam writes, even though a person has to be ba'al b'chol oina, in order to fulfill pruvu, you have to do it as quickly as possible. The Rambam does not make any such statement with regards to v'la'ar v'al tanach yadecha. He doesn't say you have to be ba'al b'chol oina in order to be fulfilled v'la'ar v'al tanach yadecha, which implies that there isn't that same urgency in order to fulfill it. And the Aruch HaShulchan and Birkei Yosef interpret that that's because the opinion of the Rambam is that it's more of a hidur mitzvah, of course very important, but not treated in the same way as pruvu, and there wouldn't be the same urgency to fulfill the mitzvah. So in terms of spacing, after a person has fulfilled the basic mitzvah of a one, you know, pruvu, having one boy, one girl, pushing off having other children is not as pressing an issue as fulfilling pruvu right away. But pruvu should be filled right away. But arval tanach yadecha, many poskim can feel that there is more leeway in terms of pushing it off. In fact, the Chazon Ish, though, was of the opinion that every mitzvah in the Torah that isn't given a specific time, there isn't just an inyan of zrizim makdim on the mitzvahs to fulfill it at the earliest possible opportunity. But if you push it off, it would even be a form of bitul mitzvah. Because since the Torah doesn't specify a time, every moment is its time, and it's every time you push it off is kind of a bitul ha-mitzvah. So therefore, at the beginning of the wedding, it's you know, when the couple, of course, has not fulfilled pruvu yet, so then there is that sense of urgency to fulfill pruvu right away. There's room to push off for different concerns, but Rabbi Wilk felt that pruvu, the primary mitzvah, because of Jesus and Ma'akdim and Lamitzis and bitul ha-mitzvah, should be fulfilled right away. After that, perhaps push it off. Therefore, Rabbi Willig suggests that even women who are interested in controlling their period prior to the wedding to avoid a chuppas nida shouldn't start on birth control, because he felt if they start on birth control, it will lead to birth control throughout the first stages of marriage, and then who knows. So he developed a pill together with an endocrinologist. Did he mention it this year? Yeah. A pill together with an endocrinologist in Riverdale. And Dr. Greyjauer, which is just a hormone that regulates the cycle without acting as a contraceptive, cool, just based on a hormone agestin. So he is a big proponent of just using that kind of, in order to regulate the period, as opposed to using typical birth control. But in terms of spacing, even after one child, we felt there was room to space. You know, you don't have to have one child, then the second child right away. In fact, you shouldn't. The police can say, the doctors say, and of course, within the first year, it's not even healthy for the mother to have a child right away after the other child. And then Rabbi Willock felt, since the Gemara says in Masechtas Nida, some woman nursed for 2 years or even 3 years, he was willing to go up to 2 years to space between the first child and even the second child, even if a person hasn't fulfilled the entire mitzvah puruvu yet, nothing to do with Arval Tanach Yadecha, even if you haven't fulfilled the basic mitzvah puruvu, Rabbi Willock felt that it was definitely legitimate to push off having the second child for, you know, to space the children by 2 years. That was in order to focus on the first child before you go on to the second child. But
before the pregnancy,
Said spacing for 2 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well,
I would assume he means once she's pregnant, she can't nurse anymore, the first baby. So he's basing himself on 2 years. Yeah. But Rabbi Willock did make the emphatic point, I think this year again, that financial concerns are not a factor, in his opinion, are not a factor in any of this, and should not intercede in terms of making these kinds of decisions. However, it is important to note that some do disagree with Rabbi Willock. Rabbi Willock is emphatic about his position, as is every right to be. But many who disagree, and it's important to be aware of it. The Mishnah tells himself this August that Ben Chamish LeMikra, Ben Eser, 5 years, go through the whole, you know, beginning development of the child. At 5 years this, at 10 years this, 15 years that. And then the Mishnah says that 18 is Ben Yun Ches L'Chupa. So the Beis Shmuel asks over here at the beginning of Puravu, Semen Aleph, Sefkan Gimel, why is it Ben Yud Ches? It should be Ben Yud Gimel. All mitzvahs begin at 13. Why is Puravu any different? So he explains that it's because a person has to spend time learning. The Gemara says in Masechtas Kiddushin, Rechaim V'Tzavar, V'Yasek B'Torah, if a person is going to be married, how is he ever going to learn Torah? He's not going to be able to learn Torah. He has already his the Ol HaParnasa. Therefore, the Mishnah recommends not to get married at 13, but rather to push it off to get married a little bit later on at 18. And this might not just be a practical consideration, it might be because this is itself part of the mitzvah of Puruvu. The Gemara says in Masechet Sanhedrin, Kol Malamed is Ben Chaveiro Torah, Mal V'Kasev Kili Yoladu. Anybody who teaches his friend child Torah, the Torah considers as if he gave birth to that child. Perhaps because the Minchas Chinuch writes, at the beginning of creation, the mitzvah of Puruvu was Meluas Haaretz V'Kivshua, was to populate the world. However, after the Torah was given, many of the mitzvahs changed. The mitzvahs that were given to all of humanity has changed, and now they were only limited to Klal Yisrael. Only Klal Yisrael has the mitzvah of Puruvu. The Umasayilim no longer have the mitzvah. So Minchas Chinuch claims, it's not one of the seven mitzvahs Bnei Noach. So the mitzvah claimed, the Minchas Chinuch claims that perhaps the mitzvah of Puruvu changed. Before it was to populate the world, and now it's to... It's to pass on the Messiah from one generation to the next. That's why the Rambam writes in Hilchos Yisurei Bia, where he deals with this issue, the Rambam writes that if a person has children when he's not Jewish, and then he converts, so we pass like Rabbi Yochanan that he's in fulfillment of the mitzvah of Puruvu. However, the Rambam adds, which is not found in the Gemara, that that's only if the children convert as well. Not only did he convert, but the children later converted, then he's in the mitzvah, fulfillment of the mitzvah of Puruvu. If the children did not convert along with the parents, they're not in fulfillment of the mitzvah of Puruvu. And that's what's quoted in Shulchan Aruch, the Menachem of Siv Zayin, is that in order to fulfill Puruvu, both have to convert. Why should they both have to convert? So we should have to suggest that perhaps it's been thinking in the name of Salvechik, that perhaps it's because the mitzvah of Puruvu is to pass on the Messiah from one generation to the next. So even if he converts, how can he fulfill the mitzvah of Puruvu with non-Jewish children? It's only if the children also convert that he's passing on the Messiah from one generation to the next, then he could be fulfillment of the mitzvah of Puruvu. In fact, it says in the Shulchan Aruch, Sif Aleph, that a person in order to fulfill Puruvu has to have one boy and one girl. That's the opinion of Beis Hillel. What if he has two boys? So the Yushalmi says, a kal v'chomer. If a person fulfills Puruvu with one boy and one girl, so it sounds like from the Talmud Bavel, if you have two boys, you're not in fulfillment of Puruvu, because you now don't have both genders that we need in order to continue to populate the world. The Yushalmi says, no, it's a kal v'chomer. If you fulfill it with a boy and a girl, kal v'chomer, you'd fulfill with two boys. And that's how the Avnei Nezer paskins. And there's also a Zohar HaKadosh in this week's parasha, or next week's parasha, that Moshe Rabbeinu separated from his wife after he had two boys. It says the Zohar HaKadosh, how could he separate from his wife after he had only two boys, not a fulfillment of Puruvu? No, because if you fulfill the mitzvah with one boy and one girl, Kal V'Chomer, you would fulfill with two boys. Well, actually, what was the Kal V'Chomer that you fulfill with two boys? I would say it has to be specifically a boy and a girl. So the Amazer perhaps explains that it's because the mitzvah, Puruvu, part of the mitzvah is to pass on the Messiah from one generation to the next. So if that's the nature of the mitzvah, so if you have two boys who both are in full obligation, including the obligation of Talmud Torah, how much more so then a person will be in fulfillment of Puruvu than as opposed to having one boy and one girl, a boy is obligated in Talmud Torah and a girl is not obligated in Talmud Torah. So if the nature of the mitzvah of Puruvu is to pass on the Messiah from one generation to the next, then it makes a lot of sense why the Mishnah tells the Masechet Tzavos that a person is not obligated to get married until the age of 18 when he's had time to learn. Because the whole nature of the mitzvah is to pass on the Messiah. If you don't know anything, you haven't acquired any part of the Messiah, what are you passing on to the next generation? It doesn't make sense to fulfill Puruvu before a person has learned. And that's why in our times, the minig has become to push it off even past 18, because don't feel we are in a position yet to pass on the Messiah, either maturity-wise or Talmud Torah-wise or financially, to pass on the Messiah or to raise children, to pass on the Messiah from one generation to the next. And some yeshivas used to have a saying, 24, not before. And in modern times, it's become a little in vogue to get married a little bit earlier. But that's totally legitimate to push off getting married till a person feels that he's in a position to properly raise children and pass on the Messiah to the next generation. So Shlomo has told me many times that he feels if a person has this hetter to push off having Puruvu, it doesn't matter whether he's married or he's not married. If he wants to get married at 20 because he feels that he's found the right person, but he doesn't feel that he's ready, Talmud Torah-wise or, in terms of his own, development, ready yet to have children, so then the same heter that we have to push it off to 18 would apply to him, even though he's married. Rabbi Willig felt that if you're old enough to get married, you're old enough to have children, which, again, he's entitled to that position, but there are those who disagree that just like you could push off getting married, even if you're married, one would be perhaps entitled under certain circumstances to push off approval as well. Yeah.
All these reasons we mentioned for putting off have to do with not being...
You have to be able to educate your children. No, I'm not saying if a guy wants to wait till he gets, you know, his third doctorate that you have a head to push off peruvu. Yeah.
Actually, I think this, again, the mix, I thought I was going to start giving a shiur here at 1:30. You're going until 2:30?
We're going to 2:30, yeah. You want us to move? Or is that what's next door?
Okay, I mean, back to, where's, right here, where it says Helen Spatz?
I don't know. There's no place
in that's a bigger room. I'm going to have only a few people, so I don't know. I'm just not sure.
We're just today. We're not going to be any other day.
Right, okay. So I just have to... All right, we'll see who... If you say here, I just have to figure out where I can go.
So just try next door. Yeah.
Okay.
It should be all right. Sorry, I apologize. Yeah.
In the case of the Ger, where we're saying that the whole kid of Peru, that they convert so that the kid converts, that he can be Sarah, he's not related to his kids, so why can't he be the kind that was somebody else's kids? Who cares that it was his kids? It's irrelevant.
Correct. Perhaps.
He doesn't need his kids to convert. As long as he has to go teach Torah to somebody.
Right, but it sounds like it's more than that. It's a good point. There must be some then relationship. Yeah, I don't know, but it says, yeah, but the Gemara says if he had children before and then he converts, he's in fulfillment of the mitzvah. So, and I don't think that's just the ki'ilu yalado of Hamalamed has been for their Torah. Yeah, you're right. There must be still some residual relationship. Yeah. But Shetla did feel that financial concerns do play into the picture of how many children a person has and how quickly he has them. If you want to just, you know, see an interesting discussion about it, Rabbi Shetla once gave shiurim consecutively for Torah Web, for Judah Diamond and Tinek about this issue. Rabbi Will got upset his position, and Shetla got upset his position. So if you want to, unbeknownst to each other. So if you want to take a look, I'm sure it's recorded somewhere. Interesting back and forth. And both positions are out there, and you should be aware of it and do your own investigations as you advise couples about how they should proceed. Well, after, let's say, you know, we've addressed the peruvu issues and the couples, shiduchim has proceeded. So then, before the wedding, we will discuss going about creating the halachic prenup, which, of course, is a great need in our community in order to prevent tragic situation of Aguna. I always explain to the couples before I do it that this is not about you, this is about the community, in order to put a positive spin about it. And just like every couple wants to do chesed before they get married, so this is a chesed that you're doing on behalf of the community to do this, and I do my best to put a positive spin on it. It's a heavy thing to do, so yeah, do your best to sugarcoat it as much as possible. However, there are two hurdles to the halachic prenup, as we will discuss. The first is that we don't, you can't have a get ma'usa, a get that's been forced upon.
We're going in there, some people, they're going to get out. If anyone else comes here, tell them I'm right.
By all means, of course, sure. Okay. Is a get ma'usa can't be a forced get, and a financial penalty would also constitute a forced get, according to the Ramban. The second hurdle is we can't have a smachta, any kind of conditional obligation of money is not binding, because a person always is optimistic and hopes that he'll never incur that conditional obligation, and therefore wouldn't have any halachic validity. So in order to overcome these two hurdles, number one, of Asmata, so we will suggest that the halachic prenup could be me'achsha bebezin choshuv, which overcomes the hurdle of Asmata, and the financial penalty they couched in terms of chiyuv mezonos, of an obligation to support one's wife, and not a penalty for not giving the get. The two challenges to halachic prenup have been, number one, that the penalty seems, some have argued, is too high. Maybe in certain circles, you know, one of Rabbi Sternbach's objections is that the financial penalty, the chiyuv mezonos is too high for mezonos, and therefore it more resembles a financial penalty, and we will defend it how he feels that it is not too high. Others still argue that the chiyuv mezonos shouldn't apply to a wife who's not living together with the husband. Maybe he's not obligated in mezonos, and all these kinds of issues, which we will discuss the ins and outs of all the issues. And he felt that we could assume it's not an asmachta, and that it we could justify it being a chiyuv mezonos, and therefore could serve to accomplish the desired result of being a deterrent for keeping one's wife an aguna. Important thing to partake in. Yeah.
I'm sorry, you mean literally living under the same roof?
Many feel, that was one of Rabbi Bleich's objections, where Rabbi Bleich has his own prenup, which he actually formulated before Rabbi Willig in the 1970s, but for whatever reason, his was less popular and didn't gain traction that this one has. But one of his objections to this one is that why is the husband obligated to mizonis if they're not living together and all these kinds of situations. Okay.
You know, he can't appeal with her anyway.
Legally, yeah. That was one of his objections. Why is the husband chayvim mizainus? You could research the issue. Why is the husband chayvim mizainus if they're not living together? If they're not living together, so they're not chayvim mizainus. So we will argue that, it depends whose fault it is why they're not living together. If it's his fault, it's her fault. But the problem is, by the time we figure out whose fault it is, it's going to be 10 years that she's an aguna. So that's why we instituted artificial chayvim mizainus. But it's not a financial penalty. It's... We're formalizing a chiyuv mizonos. It could be implied by the ksuba. So what do we need it for? We have the ksuba. The answer is the ksuba only kicks in once we determine that it's his fault. If it's her fault, then not. And to avoid all the assigning fault, we made this kind of chiyuv mizonos that's in a separate document. The Rabbi Blech always used to begin Seder Kiddushin, which he used to do this section of the fourth year, with the always encouraging statement that the Gemara tells us in Masechtas Kiddushin, Kol She'eino Day B'Tivgin V'Kiddushin Lo Yehelo Esek Iman. So he used to say, I don't know what I'm doing here. If you're new Yodei B'Tivgin V'Kiddushin, what do you need me for? If not, then my, you know, four Shiurim or six Shiurim on the Seder Kiddushin are not going to help you. You know, Zil Gemar, go out and learn and become Yodei B'Tivgin V'Kiddushin, which always helped the program, you know, like Shkayach. You know, thank you. But it is curious, why does the Gemara put Gittin before Kiddushin? What a pessimistic view of marriage. We're already starting with the divorce before we started with the Kiddushin. So because of that, the Pesachei Tshuva quotes from some Achrayim who don't understand this statement of the Gemara literally, that it doesn't mean anybody who's not a Baki, but if given the Kiddushin, shouldn't be a Masada Kiddushin, as we'll see. It's not that hard to be a Masada Kiddushin, unless unusual situation arises, and the typical situation is not that hard. Most rabbis... managed to do it. Rather, the Taz writes that it's referring to, that's why Gittin is before Kiddushin, it's referring to an unusual situation, you know, a second marriage, or something that's out of the ordinary, not your typical Seder Kiddushin. That's why Gittin is before Kiddushin. So you shouldn't issue an original Hayrah in Kiddushin unless you're Yodei B'Tiv Gittin V'Kiddushin, or perhaps get involved in second marriages unless you're Yodei B'Tiv Gittin V'Kiddushin. However, nonetheless, the Gemara's statement does loom large. Kol She'ein Yodei B'Tiv Gittin V'Kiddushin, unless you feel that you're a Baki in all of these halachas, to proceed with somewhat of a caution. So that's why I always recommend, or we did as well, that to fill out the ksuba, the tanoim, fill it all out before. Don't be the hero who has to fill out everything at the chasen's tish with people banging and yelling in your ear and different things. Fill it out before when it'll be yishuv hadas, and even with that, make sure always to come with extras. In terms of filling out the shtar tanoim, Moshe really took the teeth out of what the tanoim was about with all of the penalties and obligations. And therefore, Rabbi Willig, as many others have noted, the tanoim really don't signify or accomplish too much. But nonetheless, it is the practice to write a shtar tanoim, and we should continue the practice. Rabbi Blatt suggests that perhaps the reason why we continue to do Shtar Tanayim is because Mara says that Rav Man get Amanda the Mekadesh below Shiduchi. Rav used to give Malkus to someone who gets married without proper engagement period. And our engagement is not a Shiduchim. Rather, Shiduchim implies some sort of obligation or commitment to go through with the marriage. So therefore, he felt that the Tanoim, even if it's only a few moments, but we have official Shiduchei, before the wedding. And the reason why that was the case is because he said it was in order to prevent the drunken sailor effect of the guy who was here for Fleet Week and decides to find the girl and gets married, you know, on the fly. We don't want that kind of Kiddushin in Klal Yisrael. It can only lead to problems. So therefore, Rav Man get Amanda Mekadesh below Shiduchei. There should be an obligation period before when they commit to go through with the wedding, and then they should follow through with it. He, even himself, though, gave the disclaimer that probably paying for the caterer or even booking a caterer is enough of a financial obligation to constitute the shiduchi, the shtar tanoim also probably still not necessary, but nonetheless that is the practice, and one should continue with the practice. But once you've so you have to fill out the shtar tanoim and also the shtar ksuba, which again should probably be best if it would be done before you ever get to the wedding. In terms of filling out the tanoim, which were less mock bit about, because again, the time have less, don't really meaningless after the wedding is completed for sure. But the ksuba, there are many conventions about how to properly fill out the ksuba, and that's why I gave you this sheet from the Madrich. You can familiarize yourself with the conventions. The day of the week follows Bereishis, so if you have a Chumash, you know, there, you could just look it up. Follows the days of the week as they appear in Chumash Bereishis. Of course, in the Madrich, the one page of instructions is a Tel Sofer over here. Bashishi is Moe, it's not supposed to be Moe, and the Chumash is Chaser. So make sure that you get that right. The day of the week, if you have a sitter, is the same as Sfiras HaOmer. So it follows the same general rules, Yom Echad, then Yomim, and then after you get you know, past 10, then it becomes Achad Asar Yom. The digits comes before the tens, just like Sfiras HaOmer. So if you have a Chumash and a sitter there, you can basically just look this up on the spot, but again, try and figure it out before. When you're filling out the year, so year is Zachar. Year is what? Year is Chodesh is Zachar. So Chodesh is Yomim. But the year is Nekeva. I'm sorry, Shana is Nekeva. So there the numbers are Belosh and Nekeva. And there's always supposed to be a Vav in between each one. So, you know, Chamesh is Alafim Ushvameos Vishivim, you know, Vishmona. So that's figure out how to do it. There's going to be a part of the test that deals with this. So just try and memorize it. It's not that hard. Day of the week, Bereishis, day Sfiras HaOmer, and the year is Belosh and Nekeva, and there's always a vav in between. If you make a mistake, so the Rama says, Achraos Tosofer. Let's say you left out Chamesh Salafim. We could all figure out that this document isn't 5,000 years old. It would be a museum somewhere. So if you left out Chamesh Salafim, you should be, you'd probably be all right. Even if you left out Veshivim, Chamesh Salafim Mushva Meos, we could probably figure out what you're talking about. But sometimes you can't figure out what you're talking about. Like I was once at a wedding, the guy left out the month. There was no month. And it happens. These things happen if you fill out a ksuba on the spot. So don't do that. And we couldn't figure out based on. We tried to figure out: is there any other, you know, that year? Is there any other this day of the month that falls out during this day of the week? Which we could figure out. It must be talking about this month, and it wasn't. We couldn't work it out. So we have to redo the ksuba. So make sure that you fill out the date properly. But what day should you write? So whatever day of the calendar it is. But what if the chuppah is going to be one day and chasen? Tishrei, you're going to fill out the ksuba, is going to be another day. So Ramayish, as we mentioned, felt that a shtar muktam is possible because you're tired from lukucho shaloi kedin. You're going to come to collect from people you sold properties to unjustifiably. So you can't predate a shtar. But a shtar meuchar is kosher. So Ramayish felt we should post-date it to the time of the chuppa, not sign it dated to the time of the chasen stish. And others disagree in the sefer ksuba kochasi, quotes from Shlomo Zalman, they should date it the day of the chasen stish. That's the time when the chasen is makabel kinyan. That's when he's obligating himself in the obligations of the ksuba. Yes, it's true, subject later to the fact that they're going to get married, as states in the ksuba, but he's already obligating himself from the moment that he's makabel kinyan, from the time that he picks up the pen or the handkerchief or the yarmulke or whatever he's picking up. From that moment on, he's obligating himself in the obligations of the ksuba. So you can predate it from the time of the chasen stish. And that's Rabbi Shechler's opinion, is that it should be predated from the time of the chasen stish. And the Nefesh HaRav, I think he quotes from the Rav Salvechik, that at one point in his life he was noeg, you know, like Rav Moshe, to post-date it. The other point in his life he was noeg to do it earlier, which in my, and then I don't know what to do with that. So how is that instructive in any way? So I don't know what to make of that. But Rabbi Willig felt that perhaps the Holish could be avoided if, typical Rabbi Willig style, who said you have to fill out the ksuba, the chasen's tish? If the chuppah is going to be later, then sign the ksuba right before the chuppah. And don't do it at the chasen's tish. And so he felt you could always probably avoid the issue. If it's so close to the shkia, just fill out the ksuba a little bit later than the chasen's tish and avoid the whole issue. Because if you fill it out during Bein HaShemoshes, everyone agrees that it's post-dated. Everyone agrees you do the later date. So in that way, you could probably avoid most of these shilas. But I don't think we have to tell couples to arrange their wedding, you know, so we could avoid this shila. We're big, you know, big people. We could figure out how to negotiate the shila without telling people when to make the wedding. After you fill out the date, yeah, you want to ask something?
Is there any downside to post-dating?
So the downside to post-dating it is that you're going to make a kabbalas kinyan. That's what Rabbi Shechter is opposed to. You're going to make a kabbalas kinyan, let's say, Sunday, and the shtar is dated Monday. So the Kabbalah's Kinyan, you can do a Kinyan that's Chal, or Lachar's Man, but not the Maisa Kinyan still has to be around. So let's say you do a Kinyan Kesef, Lachar's Man, the money has to be around. If the money's not around, the Kinyan can't be Chal, Lachar's Man, that's called Kalsa Kinyonoi. So many feel that by a Kinyan Sudar, which doesn't have a long-lasting effect at all, it's just in that minute of time when you picked up the handkerchief symbolically, you're obligating yourself and the obligations of the Ksuba by picking up the pen. After that moment passes, it's called the Kinyonoi. So how can that Kinyan be Chal Lachar's Man?
Can you use the Kinyan
Kesef? What Kinyan? No, the obligations of the Ksuba is based on Kinyan Suda. That's, yeah, that's what we do.
But
Kinyan
could just be Chal now, but the
Shtar
says later.
If it's Chal now, then it's Chal now.
Okay.
So then right now. Why would you write later? If you write later, then it's not Chal till later. So then it's...
Writing later makes it Chal later.
She's saying, let's say it'd be Chal now. But we just write later.
Yeah.
I guess you could do that, but if you feel it's Chal now, right now, why would you write later? You hear what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Rav Moshe felt it's not Chal until the wedding takes place. So then many argue, if that's the case, you don't get anything by post-dating the shtar because the Kabbalah's Kinyan was yesterday. So that's Kalsa Kinyanoi. So that's why many are boxed into the corner that it's Chal. The Chassam needs to obligate himself from the time of the Kabbalah's Kinyan. After you fill out the date in the shtar, so then you have to fill out the place where the Kinyan, the place where the Chuppah is taking place. Always the convention is to give a descriptive term to the name of the place. If it's a city, you can write city. If you're not sure if it's a city and you write city, that's a mistake. So then people will be confused what town you're talking about. So that's why it's always safer to write Masa, which just means place, and the descriptive term comes before the name of the city. So let's say it would be Masa, New York. We generally don't write neighborhoods. You don't write Washington Heights or any, Hell's Kitchen. You don't write these kind of things in a shtar. There are some notable exceptions, but generally speaking, we don't write neighborhoods because the names of neighborhoods change. That's why we also don't write names of states. Names of states or even countries can sometimes change. That's why we typically write the name of the city. Cities are less likely to change. There are notable examples, we know, but typically speaking, the names of cities don't change. That's why the convention has been to write the name of the city. If you need some other identifying quality, so let's say you want to write Brooklyn and it's in Brooklyn, Pennsylvania, you'd probably be well served to write Brooklyn, Bimedinas, Pennsylvania. You don't have to write a descriptive term, but Rabbi Bleich used to say, if you don't write Bimedina, if you're going to write the name of the state, at least write Bimedinas. He said, if you don't write it, he said, you're just telegraphing to the whole Olam that you're Eino Yodea B'Tiv Gittin V'Kiddushin. He said, because that's the convention. Do you have to write it? No, but he felt that was the convention, that it should be Masa, Brooklyn, Bimedinas, Pennsylvania. Or Will Gennar Shechter recommended to me, whenever you're Masada Kiddushin in a little town that people don't know where it is, you should write Bimedinas, and then the name of the state. Even though we don't write the names of neighborhoods, there are notable exceptions like Brooklyn and Queens and Far Rockaway. That's because these were used to be cities, and they were established for Ksivas Gittin V'Kiddushin based on, at that point in time, and we always preserve that tradition. So that's why those neighborhoods are exceptions. But generally speaking, we don't write neighborhoods. Even with all of these, with these arguments, it says in the Sefer Nisuin Kilchasa, the Chazanish, when he was Masada Kiddushin, Bnei Brak used to write Zichron Meir Bnei Brak. Zichron Meir is the name of a neighborhood, not a city, and there's no descriptive term. He didn't write Medinas Bnei Brak. And there are many who just write Brooklyn, New York. I'll tell you that there are many that do that. But my understanding is that that's not the convention, and we should try and conform to the convention. What if it's, if there's an established name of this city, follow the established name of the, it's obvious if it's an established, but what to do. So call the Rav of the town, find out how to spell the name of the city, and you follow that that established tradition. What if there is no established tradition, which many times people make exotic, weddings in different places. So how do you go about writing the name of the city where the wedding is taking place? So there are just a few basic rules of transliteration. This itself is a whole limud bifnei atzmo, just in terms of basic rules, which you should be familiar with, is going to be relevant to names as well. There's some basic rules of transliteration. separation. The Rama writes in Simen Kuf Chavav that we follow the way that the name of the city, if it's been established, we follow the way that it's been established. Even if it's incorrect, it doesn't follow the convention of transliteration, so then we follow that tradition. But if it hasn't been established, then you have to transliterate based on the way that it is pronounced, not the way that it's written, the way that it's pronounced. At that time that you're establishing it. In fact, in Passaic, which is where I live sometimes, so in Passaic, the Passaic used to be a big Jewish community, then it dwindled now, they've had a resurgence. And Patterson also used to be a big Jewish community, and Newark also. And they sit on the Passaic River, and they were established for Git and Vikidushin. But Passaic, when you're Masader Get, they always write the names of nearby rivers. The way that Passaic River is written, if you're Masader Get in Newark, is different than the way that it was Huchzuk in Patterson and different than the way that it was Huchzuk in Passaic itself. Three different ways to spell Passaic based on where you are. So once it's been established, it's been established, but you go based on the way that it was pronounced. Obviously, it was different communities. Galatianers, people spoke differently and therefore was pronounced differently. But it's always transliterated based on the way that it's pronounced, not the way that it's spelled. So the double consonants have no place in transliteration, even though buffalo is hufsuk with two pays, but generally speaking, but that's how it was established. But generally speaking, to have double consonants doesn't make any sense, or Stephen, doesn't matter whether you spell with a PH or a V, all these things don't really matter. It's the way that it's pronounced. And the convention has been to transliterate it based on Ashkenazi, Yiddish, tradition. You'll say, why? All of language is just convention. It doesn't have to be a certain way. It's just the way that it is. We've all agreed to do things in a certain way. So too, transliteration, what's been established is the rules of transliteration are based on Ashkenazi Yiddish tradition. That existed well before the emergence of modern Hebrew and all of its rules. So however progressive you are and you want to integrate that as part of your rules of transliteration, that's, not for, I'm not going to comment on that, but the way that I've been raised is to maintain the tradition of Ashkenazi, Yiddish, because Ashkenazim were here before the Chassidim, so Ashkenazi, Yiddish transliteration has been the convention. But because things go based on the way that it's the way we pronounce it, not the way that it's written. So let's say New York, this was a big machlekes in the Agudas HaRabbanim, how should we spell New York, even though it's written N-E-W, and some do write Nun Yud Vav, the convention is to write Nun Vav Aleph. Nu, that's the way we pronounce it, not the way that it's written Niu. It's pronounced Nu, and therefore it should be written Nun Vav Aleph, that's the tradition. Because also we go based on the Yiddish transliteration, the J sound really doesn't have the obvious address anywhere in the Aleph base. The Gimel is like Rehov Melech George. That's a new innovation. So in order to kind of create a J sound, the person can have big machlekes about it. I think that the established way of going about doing it is Dawid Zayin Shin. So if you're being Masada Kedushin in some of the Medinas, New Jersey, so it would be Dawid Zayin Shin. And the convention is to write Jersey. Why? Because that's the way they used to speak. So you want to switch it, I'm not going to stand in your way, but that's the way that it was Huchzuk in many, Jersey cities, Huchzuk in that way. So the rule of consonants is based on the way that it's pronounced, not the way that it's written. What about vowels? So if you're not familiar with Yiddish, this will be more foreign to you. But the vowels are that a kamat is an aleph, a segol is an ayin, a tseri and a chirik are a yud, and a shuruk, which is the u sound, is a vav. Pasach and shvat generally don't get any nikud. But that's the way it generally is. Again, a kamat is an o, is an aleph, segol, e is an a, is an ayin, the tseri and the chirik is a yud, and the shuruk is a vav. Pasach and the Pasach and the Shva don't really get anything. It's like Kalman or Zalman. There's no aleph there. It's just a kuf lamed mem nun without any vowelization. Yeah.
Isn't Sarai 2 yuds?
No, that's the I sound, like Isaac. I is 2 yuds. A or E is 1 yud. So Rabbi Black used to say it makes a difference. If you're lib, it's lamed yud yud beis. If you're Lab is Lamed Yud Beis. Rebuk felt even Lab is Lab because Ashkenazi win, and Ashkenazi would pronounce, not Chassid would say Lab. a Litvish guy would say leib. So even leib is leib. But I don't know. that much, I don't know. Yeah.
Did Sephardic communities accept the pre-established tradition?
I can't speak to what, but we were Ashkenazim were here before.
No, for sure. My question is, did they confirm?
I assume they maintain their own, as they do with many other things. I assume they maintain their own. So if you're being Masada Kedusha for a Sephardi and you're not, you should probably find out what their traditions are. Yeah.
Sarah and Nechirik have the same.
Yeah, A and E. A and E. That's the transliteration, yeah. There are some anomalies, like we don't want Lakewood would be Lamed, Yud, Kuf, Vav, 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 Dalid. But no one wanted to have three Vavs in a row, Lakewood. So the way it was established was a Machlek, because when Lakewood grew, how should they spell it? So it's Lamed, Yud, Kuf, Vav, Vav, Aleph, Vav, Dalid. We just throw an Aleph in order to make ourselves feel better. So we don't like to have three of the same letter in the world, even though like Woodburn is Vav, 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 Dalid, you know, it's an oddity, so we don't like having that. Techelam is, you can find different varieties. Boker Etan is Aleph Vav, by Bez Aleph Vav. I assume that's Rabbi Brander's fault. Bez Aleph Vav is Boker Etan. But Buffalo is just Aleph, sometimes it's just a Vav. Hoboken is a Ho, O is just a Vav. So sometimes Aleph Vav, sometimes Aleph, sometimes Vav. You find different varieties. What is a new thing in America is the A. Is the A is Tsere, but like Staten Island or Atlanta, that doesn't exist in Yiddish. So Moshe writes it should be with an ayin. Sometimes though it was Huchzuk with an aleph. San Francisco is spelled one way, San Antonio another way. Just be familiar with the fact that there is some inconsistency with regards to that. Sometimes Alex is one thing, Max is another thing. So fine. The Machlekes is with an ayin or an aleph. Yeah. Basic rules, yeah.
The law and the Staten Island should be a what?
Like Staten Island.
Right, so
I got married in Staten Island. So it's Samach Tes Ayin. Stat.
Okay.
You might have said it's Ah. Stat, or all. Anyway, other rules. Tes. TH is always Tes. There's no tough. TH is always Tes. And P sound is, there's no Pesophis. There's no end of pay in Yiddish. It's always, so Philip would be pay, Yud, Lamed, Yud, pay. Be assured there will be a question about this on the test, so try and familiarize yourself. An easy example, which fits in with the rules. There are more advanced examples, but you should be familiar with somewhat with the rules of transliteration. Right. It could come up not only the name of cities, but if you have the name of Chas and Kala too, yeah.
Where are these rules?
Is there a place?
It's kind of a Teresh about pay. It's in the pack. It's in the old Ishus information. Rabbi Henkin has rules. But this is the general... these basic rules are not... if you chaz them, you'll see it fits in with a number of examples. There are rules about how to spell cities. It's a Rabbi Sandrovic from Milwaukee who has a kuntres called Kuntres Ha'aretz La'areha. I'm sure it's available in the library. Who goes through every major city that's been established for Gemvi Kiddushin, how it's spelled and why. He has footnotes explaining all the rules and... basically why each one is an exception to the rule, conforms to the rules, or whatever. Anyway, it's a whole science, so but you should be familiar with the fact that it's a whole science, and if you're dealing, it's always a good idea to pass it around to people who have a little bit more experience, certainly the rabbi of the town, find out what's doing. Yeah.
What about the
country? Yeah, it helps too, but there's much more than appears there. In terms of the name of the chassan and the kala, so that appears numerous times throughout the ksuba. Only the first and the last time did we write the parents' name, not just the name of the chassan and kala, but the parents as well. Rabbi Will discussed you have to write Hakohen and Levi every time, or only when the father's name is mentioned. I have to rehash that whole discussion, because sometimes the father could be a Kohen, will the son be a Kohen, the father's a Levi, will the son necessarily be a Levi. Generally speaking, people write it the whole time. He argued he didn't have to write it the whole time, but that was that whole discussion. The first time the chassan is mentioned, he's habocher. After that, he's chassan dinan, because the ksuba tells the story of the wedding, and he's not a chassan at the beginning, he's only a chassan at the end. And afterwards, the first time she's psula or whatever she is, after that it's moras, because she got married. So, but the first time she's not maras, it's important to be aware of what is taking place over here in the ksuba. Names, if you're not using a tip, you know, a form ksuba, names should always be written on the same line. If the guy's name is Chaim Yaakov, his name is Chaim Yaakov. It's not Chaim and Yaakov, one grandfather and the other grandfather. The name is Chaim Yaakov. We don't tell people this, but it's neither grandfather. If the grandfather, one was Chaim, the other one was Yaakov, our Pi Halacha is two separate names. Chaim and Yaakov does not equal Chaim Yaakov. Those are three separate names. So they, but since Chaim Yaakov is one name, his name should be written on the one line. Ben, you know, Moshe Aaron is a separate name. That could be written on a different line. But if you're filling out on a computer or something, make sure that you have sometimes line justification and different things. Make sure to have the chassan's name on one line.
So this doesn't have to be handwritten?
You just... No, you could type it. Yeah. Fill it out on a computer if you want. If a person doesn't have a Jewish name, you don't have to, despite Uncle Moshe's encouragement, you don't have to give people a Jewish name. It's not... It's this week's parasha, actually, but you don't have to give them a Jewish name. Rabbi Barach used to brag every Shabbos they make a Mishaberach and his shul for June Bas Pauline. You don't have to give people a Jewish name, and in fact, it could create problems with them if it later gets lost or forgotten. So if people, a person doesn't have a Jewish name, just to use your, whip out your rules of transliteration and transliterate the name. If a person was given a name and they don't use it, let's say the father's not religious and he hasn't used his name since he doesn't know when, that's still his Jewish name. We assume a person was given a Jewish name when they're a baby. That Jewish name sticks with them. If a person has a name from Tanakh, obviously it's spelled the way that it would be spelled in Tanakh. Or if it's a biblical name, it's spelled with a hey at the end. If it's the guy's name is Aaron, it should be spelled the way it's spelled in Tanakh, without a vav. I don't care that he spells it Aharon with a vav. The way it's spelled is the way that it appears in Tanakh. David is, even if he's not religious and was never called David in his entire life, in the Ksuba it's David. That's the way it's written in based on the way it's written in the Kodesh. So let's say if it has, if it's a Yiddish name, so then it ends with an Aleph. That's the general rule. Biblical names end with an A, Yiddish names end with an Aleph. If it's, let's say, Adina or Ilana or Aliza, so people write these with a hey, whatever. So if Ilana, Adina appears in Tanakh, even though it's a man's name, I think, in Tanakh. But if it, whatever, you know, I'm not going to pick a fight with somebody. But if it's Fago or Shayna or you know, then it should be written with an Aleph. But in terms of how to write people's names in different situations, so the Paiskim do discuss whether or not you have to write the name of the family name. Rav Moshe in the Gros Moshe writes that a person should write the family name because we are Choshesh L'Shnei Yosef Ben Shimon B'Yerachas, we're afraid that there might be two people with the same name in the city. Therefore, it would help as an identifier to write the family name. Rav Salvejik also, I think Rav Shechter quotes from Rav Salvejik, also was in favor of writing the family name. But when you write with Mikra, then we are not Choshesh L'Shnei Yosef Ben Shimon, so probably no obligation to write the family name. And Rav Luch felt if you write the family name, then you could you have to write it correctly based on the rules of transliteration. So we could get sticky. So in order to avoid, I think Rabbi Wilk's practice is if it's an easy name, he'll write it. If not, then he doesn't do it, something like that. Rabbi Block was very opposed to writing family names because it's hard enough transliterating the name of the city. We're going to start now with family names. It's a whole other can of worms. Rabbi Shelter feels that a person should write family names, but he also helps out a little bit. In fact, Rabbi Shelter feels that there's no wrong way of spelling something, as opposed to what I said until now. He feels that we don't have to conform to the rules of transliteration. Rabbi Shelter is more progressive, you know. So you don't have to conform to the rules of transliteration. As long as I can tell what the people meant, unless it's wrong, it's right. But the more traditional you are in terms of how you go about spelling things, you only have to know how Rabbi Shechter spells his name. He spells his name Shin Chof Tes Resh, which doesn't conform to our rules. It should be Shin Ayin Chof Tes Ayin Resh, which L'Shvach Shel Rav J.J. Shechter, that's how he spells his name, Shin Ayin Chof Tes Ayin Resh. That's probably how it should be spelled. Or Schwartz should be Shin Vav Vav Aleph Resh Tzadi. But some spell it Shin Vez Resh Tzadi. That's a Hebraicized way of, way of spelling it. So, but the more latitude, the more flexible you're willing to be on how you spell things, so the easier it is to go about writing the names of families. Or Shelf is pretty flexible, so he's in favor of it. The more traditional you want to be in terms of sticking to the rules of transliteration, the more difficult it becomes. I'll just tell you, I have one of my very distinguished Baal HaBatim. His wife's name is Golda. And they've been going back and forth for years how to spell the name Golda. So finally, he asked Reb Chaim Kanievsky, he's called Reb Chaim Kanievsky, he asked Reb Chaim Kanievsky how to spell Golda. He sent a letter how to spell Golda. So Reb Chaim Kanievsky sent back, this was in the days when he sent back postcards. Now you can't get a postcard, but in those days he sent back postcards. So the guy got a postcard in the mail and it was blank. So he called up the shamash, like, he sent me a blank postcard. So the guy said, I don't know. So he went to Reb Chaim. He said, Reb Chaim, he said, no, the answer is in the address. Look at how I addressed the envelope. So he addressed it to her, and he spelled Golda, Gimel Vav Lamed Dalet Hey. Which I would not. I would have spelled Golda, Gimel Aleph Lamed Dalet Aleph. But anyway, so you see that Reb Chaim Kanievsky seems to be a little bit progressive in terms of spelling things. Well, if you're one of the Edom on the Ksuba, so if they wrote family names on the Ksuba, that's been the sheet of the Masada Kiddush, and you follow the rules of the Masada Kiddush, and you write your family name. If there's no family names, then don't start being more machmer than the Masada Kiddush. And the Masada Kiddush, no family names in the Ksuba, don't start writing family names at the bottom. It should be, typically, the rules should be, it should be lemishpachas, Yosef ben Moshe lemishpachas Soloveitchik. That's what it should be. However, I've been told that Soloveitchik used to sign his name Yosef ben Moshe Soloveitchik without Lemishpachas. So I think the general convention is Lemishpachas, but if you feel you're such a Talmud of Soloveitchik, then don't write Lemishpachas. What if we don't know? Yeah?
I'm going to ask about Kinuyev.
Huh?
I was going to ask about Kinuyev for Chasen
Kazi. No, nobody does that. Get. That's not done. Please don't do that. There's one well-known person who does that. It's totally out of place. What if we don't know the name of the father? So it says in Shulchan Aruch Simin Kuf Chavav, the father's a guy or adopted, we don't know. So it says in the Shulchan Aruch Simin Kuf Chavav, then you just write his name. We don't write, the guy's name is Moshe. So Moshe. However, the Dogma Rav says, no, write the mother's name. If we had to say the father's not Jewish, but the mother is Jewish, and you write the mother, like we have in the Gemara, Romi Bar Rochel, and that's how the Sefer HaMadrich paskins. If the Sefer HaMadrich is worthy of a psak, Sefer HaMadrich paskins, you should write the name of the mother. However, in the Sefer Ksuba Kehilchos, he writes, you should write the name of the grandfather. So, Moshe ben Avi Imo, Yaakov or something. Okay, so I don't really have strong feelings either way, but it should somehow indicate who he is. If it's his name, mother's name, the maternal grandfather's name, either way, it doesn't really matter. Ramesha writes that if a person has an adopted parent and he wants to write the adopted parent's name, so Ramesha writes he can't do that. We have Serach Bas Osher. Serach was adopted by Osher. From a previous marriage, and nonetheless, the Chumash refers, according to some opinions, and nonetheless, the Chumash refers to her as Serach Bas Osher because he raised her. So Ramesha writes, you're allowed to write Ben or Bas, the person who raised you. But then Ramesha says, it is better to write some sort of indicator that that's the case. Ploni Ben Ploni Amagadlo, or Ploni the Miskri Ben Ploni Ben Ploni. This was so and so who's called this and that. You come up with creative ways of writing it. If the person is a ger, the tradition was to write Ben Avraham Avinu, and which is a tremendous ichus to be Ben Avraham Avinu. But many gerim are hesitant to write that and publicize their status in Shtar Ksuba, understandably so. So in the Sefer Mishnas HaGer, he writes it, which is a newer Sefer in Hilchos Ger, said you don't have to write it, particularly if it's the male is a ger. It's not going to have any relevance for future Yuchsin in terms of who he's precluded from marrying. So therefore, if he doesn't want to write Ben Avraham Avinu, we can cater to that sensitivity. If it's a woman who's a Giyores, so her status needs to be stated because she's Psul Kahuna. So it has to be indicated somewhere in the Shtar that she's Psul Kahuna. You're supposed to write Giyur Tada. If she doesn't want to write that, we can come up with some other creative solution. The Shulchan Aruch says in Siman Samach Vav Sefer Aleph that the status of the woman is supposed to be addressed in the Shtar, so it should say Be'ul Tada, Besul Tada, Giyur Tada, as we discussed. But as Rabbi Wilk mentioned, you could always write the two ksuba solution if there's a status that you would rather not publicize. Always write wrong ksuba that the Masada Kiddushin will take and hide away, and another ksuba that's going to be read underneath the chuppah. Yeah.
Can you just do pre-exit?
What do you mean, Greek?
Just read it the way
of course.
It's normally written, even if it's written in a different way.
Of course. But then the person who's reading the ksuba has to know.
Yeah.
Right, for sure. Oh, absolutely.
What is the problem?
You could get up and read Dr. Seuss if you want. It doesn't matter.
Obviously.
Right, yeah.
Is it
Basula?
What are the other?
Ba'ul Tada. Which is a little graphic, so people would rather be, Istada. Mrs. Or, but it's an indicator, oh, there's a red flag. Giurta, that means a giures. But there are other terms that can be used. if a woman was a ba'ula before the wedding, so she's she's entitled to a lower ksuba, as we will discuss at length, lower ksuba than a besula, and therefore, Moshe writes in Igros Moshe, she has to reveal that to the husband, otherwise he's going to be mechayev himself in money shaloi kedin. Rabbi Willa discussed, is it really fair to make her reveal that kind of information? He doesn't have to reveal that kind of information. So he quoted from a tshuva of the Divrei Yosef, the Kleisenberger Rebbe, that how he's never going to know anyway. He's not really going to suffer any consequences of it. If he would recognize, that she's a ba'ula, not a basula, then obviously he has experiences that he's not disclosing. So Rabbi Willig, tried to level the playing field. He even writes in that Mordechai, in the name of Zalman Nechemiah, she could tell him that she was Nansa. But I think it's just outlandish to begin a wedding by telling her he was raped and it didn't happen. I think is a crazy way to. There's better ways of solving this solution, the issue than that. But it's a hurdle that has to be overcome. That if she's a ba'ula, it should really be. It's probably best shalom bias for her to reveal that information to him. Ramosha writes, make her a din, that it has to be so. Rabbi Willig tried to do the best to level the playing field if possible. But you can write in the ksuba whatever you want. But Rabbi Black did make a big point, which is in our times, even though this is decreasingly so, honesty is not, if a person's dishonest, that would, people can tolerate lots of things, but dishonesty, especially from the rabbi, people can't tolerate. We have a higher threshold for that, in recent times, for dishonesty. But it really looks bad. So if everyone knows that the couple is living together, and you're going to write Basul Tada in the Ksuba, make a mockery of the entire thing. Or certainly if she's pregnant, write Basul Tada, it's ridiculous. So, you can write Basul, you can read Basul, or whatever you want, but if they've been living together and, marginally religious, to write Basul Tada is ridiculous. Yeah. If she's Ba'ula? No.
Yeah.
No. I don't even know if Rabbi Willig would ask. Standard Kala comes for a wedding to start asking these kinds of questions. I can't believe he does.
So does that mean Ma'isa, we're always going to be writing Ba'ula unless we're told?
No,
Basula. Why? Basula? Of course. Yes. 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 Don't get involved. Yeah, unless you have a red flag. He was only discussing if she's on a college campus. If it's his ba'ula, let's say she's a ba'ula, but it's because of him, so the Piskei Tshuva writes in Sifkan Hay, in the name of Sam Sefer, she might be entitled to the Masayim, because it's a ba'ula didei. So that might be a whole entire different situation. Shulchan Aruch writes in Simen Mem Hay, if you're not supposed to have blank spaces in the shtar, because people could fill it in with, random monetary obligations, so you should try and make a line if you have blank spaces. Usually there's not enough space, but if you have a blank space, you should make a line. But I don't think told the story this time, but at his wedding, his name is very short. Villig, Vav, Yud, Lamed. The only letter that could be extended is Gimel. Rav Soloveitchik was opposed to writing lines. Rav Moshe Rabbeinu says, you write a line like we write in a check. Rav Soloveitchik felt the lines don't belong in the ksuba, so he would elongate the letters to fill up the space. So he got stuck at Rabbi Willig's wedding. With Vav, Yud, Lamed, he can't extend too much. And then Gimel, so the Gimel's gigantic. Okay, but most write lines in the shtar. Because of that also, that we're afraid that people are going to fill in miscellaneous things in the shtar, it should really be a box. To have calligraphy ksuba in the shape of a dove or, a peace sign is wrong. You can fill in the whole thing, who knows what's going on over here. So it should really be a box, an oval. Okay, or if there's a border, so we can't really fill in around it, all right. But it should really be something that can't be manipulated. It's a typical shape, which is, a rectangular box. It's good to stick to that kind of paradigm. Also, the names of the Edim should be directly underneath the shtar. You can't have blank spaces, so, sometimes people want it to look like the Declaration of Independence, the guy's getting up reading the Magna Carta, so they have, the text up here and the Edim down here. But then you have a huge blank space, which you could write, and by the way, he owes $1 million, and the signs over his house and all of his assets. So therefore, you should, and you can't write blank lines there, because then it looks like the signatures are on the lines. So you have to make sure that the Edim sign directly underneath the text, and if you get to a wedding and they ask you, sign over here on the line, and there's a big space, you don't have to follow the instructions. You could think out of the box a little bit and sign underneath the text. Why do you have to sign on the words on the dotted line? Don't sign on the dotted line. Sign underneath the text where the signature should be. At the shtar tenoim or makabo kinyan, we makabo, maybe the both parents pick up a pen, in lieu of picking up the pen, they obligate themselves to go pick up the wedding. And at the time of signing the ksuba, the chassan picks up a pen, and in lieu of picking up the pen, he obligates himself to the obligations of the ksuba. The edim who are witnessing this, who are going to sign in the ksuba, should witness the kabbalah's kinyan. That's what they're signing about. That they witness the chassan picking up the handkerchief or the pen, which belongs to the Masada Kiddushin, or one of the witnesses. It really belongs to the Masada Kiddushin. It shouldn't be the chassan's pen. It should be your pen. He should pick up a pen, and in lieu of picking up the pen, which is not his, he obligates himself in the obligations of the ksuba. The edim should know that the chassan understands what he's mekabel upon himself. So if he's not a yeshiva bacher, you should try and explain to the chassan in front of the edim. He understands that what he's accepting upon himself. We will discuss whether you should write vikanina. The problem, people are opposed to vikanina because they wait until the kabbalah's kinyan has happened and then they fill in the vikanina. So we will, because they're afraid it looks like a mechzi kesheker, a kashikra, if you're going to have it written in beforehand. But the whole thing is mechzi kashikra. It also says the chassan proposed to the kala and they got married and then he agreed to support her. None of that happened yet. So the whole thing is mechzi kashikra. So you're not moisif in the mechzi kashikra by writing the kanina in before, and therefore in our circles we generally don't accept the chumra of filling the kanina in at the time of the ksuba. You can run into problems if you sign it and then you want to fill it in later. So we try and fill those things in before. In terms of what to use for the wedding, so it says in the Shulchan Aruch over here, Simon Chav Zayin, our minig is to be mekadesh bekesef. The Ramah adds dafka to use a ring. Many different reasons why we dafka use a ring. What if you don't have a ring? Can you use cash? The Be'er Heitev writes Simon Chav Zayin Sif Aleph in the name of the Mordechai. We're not mekadesh with cash because matbea has a tzura, a picture which gives it value, and tzura tzuras avida de batla. The image can become rubbed out, and therefore people are not semech das on cash that has an image that could be rubbed out. The Pischei Tshuva, though, of course, in the name of Avnei Miluim, of course you can use cash. Why should cash? The whole, that's the ideal Kiddushin, is Kiddushin Kesef. Of course you can use cash. So if you get stuck in a pinch, you can use cash. The Pischei Tshuva in Chayshim Mishra, of course, in the Sam Sefer, even representative money, paper money, could also be used, but don't do that. Try and make sure that the guy has a ring, and use that as the minig. Yeah, the Shulchan Aruch says over here in Siman Lamed Aleph that the ring is supposed to be worth a sheva pruta. It can be worth, of course, more than that, but it has to be worth at least a sheva pruta. And the kala should basically know how much it's worth. You know, understand the relative value of it. She doesn't have to know the price of gold or silver or platinum that day, but she should understand its general value. That's why it says in Shulchan Aruch, the minig is not to use a ring that has a stone. Because Taisim Sechtes Kiddushin quotes from Rabbeinu Tam that the woman's going to think, wow, what, he's so great, and it's cubic zirconium. Or she might think it's such what a beautiful diamond, and it's a cloudy diamond that's not worth as much as she thought. So because stones vary in value so greatly, not like gold and silver, which have established prices, so then you're not supposed to be mekadesh with a ring that has a stone. Some are machmer even for inscriptions on the ring, because she might think that it's very valuable because of the engraving, but we're not machmer for engravings. But nonetheless, the minig is to use a plain gold or silver platinum ring, yeah.
I thought in certain cases we just say he's only being
Kaddish
with the
Shabbat Purim's
worth of the ring, so
that's to
avoid any...
So the Ramah writes in Siman Lamed Aleph, Sif Beis, that we ask the Edom underneath the Chuppah, do you see that the ring is worth a Shabbat Pruta? And we do that in order so that the Kala, demonstrate the Kala agrees, whatever way, whatever it's worth, I'll get married with a Shabbat Pruta. And that's one of the reasons that the Kala covers her face. She's basically saying, I don't want to see whatever it is, I'm happy with it. Even if it's just a Shavu Pruta, she's satisfied. So because of that, the Pischei Tshuva writes, the Sivkot and Dawid, that why can't you use a ring that has a stone now? Even if it's only worth a Shavu Pruta, she's happy to get married. And the answer of Shechter quotes in the name of Ramesha Salavechik, that if she's going to cover her face and we're going to ask the Eidim underneath the Chuppah, you see it's worth a Shavu Pruta, that you can get married with a ring that has a stone, but that's not the meaning. Dar Chasuchan says, still we shouldn't do that. Even though she says she's happy with a Shavu Pruta, who knows, you know? So don't, the minig is not to use a ring that has a stone. The ring has to belong to the chassan, so therefore he has to pay for it. The Avnei Miluim has a discussion, what if he used kinyan, Kenyan, we hold, it's machlekes, which Kenyan is deraisa, Kenyan kesef or Kenyan meshicha. So we should make sure that he did both. Both he paid with kesef, he paid for it, and he had meshicha. If he only had meshicha, he didn't yet pay for it, meshicha might only be a kenyan midrabanan. Can a kenyan midrabanan work to establish a kiddushin deraisa? Very lomdish is shayla. Can a kenyan midrabanan work for deraisa? So therefore the chassan should make sure to pay for it and do meshicha on it. And even credit card bills, as machlekes is a credit card like an IOU, or perhaps in our times you treat it like cash. So, tumo back and forth. He should pay for it, pay the credit card bill, and make sure that he did meshicha on the ring. He should make sure he has a kinyan on the ring. Shulchan Aruch says in Simcha Ches, if you test, you can't. If you borrow a ring for kiddushin, it does work. Because he quotes from the Rosh in the next Sif Chaf that a Matana Manas Lahachzer also works for Kiddushin. So She'eila is like a Matana Manas Lahachzer. But the Pesachei Tshuva quotes from Mishkan Yaakov, Matana Manas Lahachzer does not work, which is a Lom D'Shashayla. If you learn the Sugi Matana Manas Lahachzer, is Matana Manas Lahachzer a full gift with a conditional, the condition that you return it, or is it a conditional gift, you know, provisionary gift, and it doesn't really belong to you, in which case you can't use it for Kiddushin. The Masada Kiddushin asks the Chassan underneath the Chuppah, he asked the Chassan in front of the Edom, is the ring yours? So he asked the Edom, do you see it's worth a Shavar Puta? He asked the Chassan, is it yours? The Edom should hear him say that it's his. The Kala should hear the Edom say that it's worth a Shavar Puta. Two questions a Masada Kiddushin should ask in front of everybody. Do you see this worth a Shavar Puta? And does the ring belong to you? What about if the Kala has a ring, the Kala's family has a ring, they want the Chassan to give to her underneath the Chuppah? So the Pesachei Tshuva, quotes from the Chassam Sefer, that the Gemara has a shaila about whether or not a woman can give paper for a get to her husband. Let's say he says, I'll write the get if you give me the paper. So she gives him the paper. But the paper belongs to her. The paper really has to belong to him. So she says, I'll give it to him. But she knows she's going to get it right back. So the Gemara's in Ibaya, the Loy of Shita, can she give him paper knowing full well she's going to get it back? Because that's very nuanced legality, that she's giving it to him, but she has to give it B'Lev Shalom, knowing full well that she's going to get it back. And the Gemara's in Ibaya, the Loy of Shita, can a woman give such a nuanced kinyan? So the Chassam Sefer claims, same thing over here. Can she give him a ring that she knows she's going to get right back? And it's a machlekes ha'paiskim, what we should do, l'mais, it's anybody to live sheet in the Gemara. So if you're going to use a ring from the Kala, make sure that it was given b'leiv shalem, and make sure they understand that he has the right to do with it whatever he wants. He could take it to marry someone else. And if they're okay with that, then it's a matana gemura. If they're not okay with that, then that's not a matana gemura, and that would be no good for kiddushin. Probably best to... Shulchan Aruch says in Simen Samach Aleph, Sif Aleph, that a chuppas nida, the machlekes rishayna between the Ran and the Rambam, that's a machlekes what chuppah is. According to the Rambam, chuppah is yichud aroy labiyah, so chuppas nida is no good. According to the Ran, it's a knisa l'ushuso, you know, going underneath the poles and the canopy. And therefore, a chuppas nida is okay. Our minig, of course, is to do a chuppas nida. If you're going to do a chuppas nida, so the Ber Heitev writes that... what do you do about putting the ring on the Kala's finger? So he quotes in the name of the Ma'aril, he should drop it in her hand. And that's a Shechter quotes in the Nefesh HaRav from Salvechik, that he should drop the ring in her hand by a Chuppas Nida. However, in the Oitzar HaPoiskim and Evin Ezer, quotes from many Poiskim who disagree. Why do you have to put the ring in her hand? First of all, you're passing thing from husband to wife. That's one of the Harchokis. Okay, the Harchokis only apply after they're married, not before they're married. Or maybe you're afraid he might cut her finger inadvertently. So the Yushalmi says in Masechta Soita that the Kohen used to put his hand underneath the hand of the Isha Soita as they did Hanafa and the Mincha Soita. They would wave it together while he was holding her hand. And the Gemara says, how could he do that? Did they put a towel in between a chatzitza? And the Yushalmi resolves, no, but it was done in front of Ha'am Va'eda, and only for a minute. We're not afraid that that this is going to lead to anything more serious. So it's over here, you're doing it b'fnei Ha'am Va'eda. It's only for a minute that he's going to put a ring, and it's only inadvertently he might touch her. So therefore, many feel by a chuppas nida, rather than telegraph or publicize to the whole olam that this is a chuppas nida, let him put the ring on her finger, kedargai. That's why Rabbi Bleich is opposed to passing many others. In our circles, we're not really so into this, passing the ksuba from the chassan to the kala. Many Masada Kiddushin will make the chassan do that in front of the Edim, like Edim Mesira. We feel that in our yeshiva, based on the tradition from Salvechik. Edim Mesira doesn't make any sense by Ashtaraya. The Ksuba only proves that he has a financial obligation. The Edim Mesira have no place. So we say, well, what's the downside? The downside is if it's a Chuppas Nida, now they are married, and she can't, he can't pass her the Ksuba. So you have that concern. So maybe it's best to avoid it, but I don't like denying people their little chumras if they want to have it. The Ramah says in Siman Nun Hei Sefal, if our minig is to make a chuppah out of poles and a cloth on top. And the Gra explains this, midin knisa l'rashuso, it's kind of like a symbolic entering into his domain. Therefore, some suggested it should be really like a Turis HaPesach, and it should be Al Gabeyem and not Menatzad. But Rav Shechter argues in the Mikveh Atzon in Simulam and Tess, where he has many discusses many issues regarding weddings, that it's not Midin Suras HaPesach and Knisa L'Rishuso, but rather Ufarasta Knafecha L'Amasecha, the Pesach in Megillas Rus, he's spreading his garment over her like the Germans do with the talus, the chasen and kala underneath the talus. That's perhaps what Bedekin is all about, is that he's spreading his garment over her. So that perhaps is what the chuppah represents. Therefore, Rav Shechter feels the chuppah should really be made out of cloth, not an ice sculpture, or flowers. There should be some sort of cloth on top of the chuppah. Perhaps it's ufarasta k'nafecha l'amasecha. Yeah.
So if he does do the talus, does it really matter?
Yeah, it doesn't matter then, okay. Yeah. Do you need Edim by the Cheder HaYichud or by the Bedekin? So interestingly enough, Edim by the Nisuin is only a recent issue. It's discussed by the Or Sameach and the Marcheshes, more recent Achrenim. Do you need Edim by the Nisuin, Edim by the Kiddushin? Of course, you do need. Without Edim by the Kiddushin is nothing. But do you need Edim by the Nisuin? It might depend whether Nisuin is the second stage of marriage or just fulfilling a condition of the first of the marriage, that they be living in the same home for obligations of the marriage to kick in. If it's the second stage of marriage, perhaps we can argue that you need Edim. If not, it's just fulfilling a condition. They live in the home in order for him to be obligated to support her. But they're fully married after the Kiddushin, perhaps you don't need Edim by the Nisuin. We're typically machmir to have Edim by the Cheder HaYichud, but it's nothing like the Edim that you need for the Kiddushin. Because of that, it's only really a Chumrah, so we also do the Bedekin before, which as we mentioned is one Shita in what Chuppah is all about, that he's spreading his garment over her. But that takes place before the Kiddushin. Can you have Nisuin before the Kiddushin? So that's a further machlokes. The Mishnah Lamelech has a discussion about that. Also probably hinges on this conceptual issue. What is Nisuin? Is Nisuin a second stage of marriage, in which case it can't be before the first stage? Or is it fulfilling a condition that they live in the same home? If they live in the same home, so they can, it's all it is just fulfilling a technical detail for obligation of the marriage to kick in, but the real marriage happens at Kiddushin, so then why can't the Nisuin happen before the Kiddushin? That's why, in my opinion, it makes no sense, based on the lumdas and the conceptual understanding of these issues, to require Edim by the Badekin. Because if it's happening before, we're obviously assuming it's just a condition. If it's just a condition, otherwise how could it be before the Kiddushin? The second stage of marriage can't be before the first. Can't take 1205 before 1204. You can't do that. So if it must be, it's just a condition. If it's just a condition, there's no reason to require Edim. Rav Shechter in the Nefesh HaRav, of course, from Salvechik, he was very mocked to have Edim by the Bedekin. I think that was just Salvechik making a point that the Bedekin is not just a photo op, but has some halachic significance, and the only way he could do that is by throwing Edim at it. But I don't know if it, I don't insist on that. The we do appoint Edim by the Kiddushin, as we will discuss, in order to single them out from the rest of the Edim who are there, to avoid a problem of Nimsa Echamehem Karav Apostle. Even though Nimsa Echamehem Karav Apostle doesn't really apply to an Eid Haroah, only to an Eid Hameid, perhaps by Kiddushin, where the only the whole role of Edim is not to testify in court, but only to witness what takes place. Edus Lekiyam Adavar, perhaps Nimsa Echamehem Karav Apostle would apply. So in order to separate them into two different groups, we have Yichud Edim. But to say to the exclusion of all others, you can't apostle people to Eidos. If you could apostle people to Eidos, we would say, every murderer would say before he murders somebody, I hereby apostle you all to Eidos. You can't apostle people to Eidos gratuitously. So it doesn't mean that everyone else is apostle. So you don't have to say to the exclusion of all others. You just mean to separate them into a separate group of Eidim. So if we appoint them as the official Eidei Kiddushin, it's implied that they're a separate group from the rest of the Eidim. The Eidim do have to witness what's taking place. That's why the Rambam writes, Simon Mem Beis Sif Dalin. They should be able to see what's going on. And the Beis Shmuel writes that it's not enough that they know what's going on. They actually have to try and see it. If they didn't see the actual act of putting the ring on a finger, maybe that's what they should see. So then perhaps we would say, Hein Hein De Yichud, Hein Hein De Bia. Even though for murder, capital punishments, that doesn't work. Just, figuring out what takes place based on circumstances. But when it comes to Kiddushin, as long as, the Chassan and the Kala went to live in the same hotel, if they were once married, the Mishnah says in the Masechtas Kiddushin, we'd say, Hein Hein De Yichud, Hein Hein De Bia. If they're living together, they probably got remarried. The one is a proof to the other. So the Igros Moshe quotes in the name of the Chassam Sofer that if you have people, let's say we find out at the wedding that the two Edom we appointed were Psulei Edus. They got arrested, shortly after for fraud and for Geneva and all these things. So we see they were Ganovim. So there's a whole Kiddushin undone. So Moshe says if there were other people who were Kosher Edus there, so we assume even though they're part of the same group of Edom as other people, as Krevim and Psula, maybe we don't have to assume them. So Echamim Kavu Apostle applies to Kiddushin. It really only applies, to Eid HaRoya. It only applies to an Eid HaMeid. And we can rely on the other people who were in the room, even though they didn't see the Kiddushin taking place, as long as there was a Rav Muvak who was arranging the marriage, then the wedding is probably okay. We can rely on those Edom in the back of the room. But the Masada Kiddushin should do the best that he can to not rely on Edus Yediyah, below Edus Re'iyah. So that's why the Pisrei Tshuva quotes the name of the Ma'arit, who quotes the name of his father, the Ma'abit. What if the face of the Kala is covered with a very heavy veil? So maybe you should lift up the veil to see her face, otherwise you don't know who's getting married. It might be Maisa, Rochel, and Leah. However, then the Ma'arit disagrees with his father. We're going to see right after the chuppah is over. She's going to pick up the veil. We're going to see right after. This is a Milsa Davidu Legluye. She's the only girl here in a white dress, hopefully, with a big train. So we're going to figure out who she is. And it's not necessary. In our circles, we really don't have that common that you see such heavy veils that you can't see the face of the kala either around or behind. But you have seen at weddings probably that they ask the kala to lift up the veil, so the Edom could see who she is. The Shulchan Aruch and Simul Amarav Siv Beis quotes a machlekes between the Rambam and the Rosh. When are you supposed to make the Birchas Erisin? Is it a Birchas HaMitzvah, Birchas Shevuah V'Hidah? The Rambam feels the Birchas HaMitzvah should be made over Lasiyas, and the Rosh is Birchas Shevuah V'Hidah. You make it afterwards, like lightning and thunder. The Shulchan Aruch paskins that we make it before, like the Rambam, over Lasiyas, and before he puts the ring on a finger. However, the Chalkas Mechaykik, the Beis Shmuel, right, we really paskin like the Rosh. We're machmir like the Rambam, we really paskin it's a Birchas Shevuah V'Hidah. But since we are machmir like the Rambam, we make it before. So therefore, if Shechta suggests that it's in the Bikvei Atzon, that the Masada Kiddushin is going to ask all these questions to the Edom, to the Chassan, does the ring belong to you? Do you see the ring is worth a Shevuah Pruta? You shouldn't do that in between the Birchas Erisin and putting the ring on a finger. You should do that before you ever make the bracha in the first place. Not to make a hefsik between the bracha and the Chassan putting the ring on the Kala's finger. Common practice is to ask after they both drink from the wine, you make a bracha, by a priyak offering, they both drink, then he's going to put the ring on the finger, then you ask the, but right before that you ask the Edom. But Shechta suggested, and it's a compelling argument, we should do it before the whole thing takes place. The Ramah says, who should make the bracha should really be the chassan, it's his mitzvah. But the Beis Shmuel says, in order not to embarrass the chassan who doesn't know how to make the bracha, we give it to somebody else. However, many others disagree that the reason why we give the bracha to somebody else is because it's really a birchas shevuah v'hidah that's incumbent upon everybody who's present. In order to give Shevuah V'Hidah to Kadosh Baruch Hu on the institution of marriage. Because it's incumbent upon everybody present to give Shevuah V'Hidah on the institution of marriage, if Shechter argues, it's also in Bikvei Atzon, that the Masada Kiddushin is going to make the bracha should not be the person who has the closest relationship with the Chassan. He's not the Chassan Shliach. He's the Shliach on behalf of the entire group that's gathered. We're all obligated to make a Birchas Shevuah V'Hidah on the institution of marriage, as the Rosh says, implied by the language of the bracha. It's nothing to do with the mitzvah of getting married. It's Shevuah V'Hidah on the institution of marriage. So it should be the greatest Talmud Chacham who's there, who we would probably all appoint to be the one who's going to make the bracha on behalf of everybody. The Shulchan Aruch says, even if the Chassan makes a mistake in terms of his one line, I always tell the Chassan, you got one line here, buddy. Haray Avin Kodesh with Habazu Kodesh Mesh of Yisrael. Practice it. I don't care how many times you got to practice it. It's your one line. You don't want to do the repeat after me shtick. You have a card. Now that you have cards, but the Chassan should be familiar with the line. He should be like reading off the card. Try and this is your one line. Get it done. So okay. But if the chassam makes a mistake, so the Shulchan Aruch says if there are sukkim ba'isa inyan, we all understand what's going on here. There's a caterer, we just had a shmor, we just went to the badek, and she's wearing a white dress. There's Aiden, the parents, the grandparents, everybody's there. We all get what's going on. So even if you made a mistake, the kiddushin would probably be valid. It says in the Shulchan Aruch, in the poskim, that you're supposed to give the kala the ring after he says his pizman. He says, Arei HaMekadosh B'Tahaz V'Kadosh Mesh V'Yisrael. Then he puts it on her finger. If he does it before or while he's speaking, she might think, oh, that's my engagement present. Now where's my real, where's the Kesef Kiddushin? If he puts it on while he's speaking, then she's gonna think it's that's an engagement present. So he's supposed to wait till he finishes speaking. Once he's done, put the ring on her finger. I've seen Masada Kiddushin when I'm in Eid Kiddushin say, put it on in the middle. I'm like screaming, no, dude, you don't know what you're talking about. You're supposed to put it on after. But Lamaisa, that's what you're supposed to do. If he put it on in the middle, it's probably a sukkim ba'isa inyan. The chassam probably, you know, could have said anything. We understand what he's talking about. So the Kiddushin's probably all right anyway, but you should know what you're doing. Again, to be a yodeh, but to give the Kiddushin, you put it on. You should put it on after he's done speaking. Yeah, and he puts it on her pointer finger, even though we know the ring finger is over here. That's a hard finger to stick out. So you put it on the conventions, you put it on the right hand to right hand. If it's a lefty, so then it's the opposite. But right hand to right hand, his right hand to her pointer finger, and then she could put it on her ring finger afterwards. Just two other things. One thing about Sheva Brachos, and then one thing about missing the ksuba. So the Sheva Brachos is supposed to be done in the presence of 10 people. Many understand that that's because it's a davar shebikdusha, like every item that needs 10 people. And that's because, just like the Birchas Erisin, it's a Birchas Sheva Vahidah that we're all obligated in, so too Birchas Nisuin is probably a Birchas Sheva Vahidah that we're all obligated in reciting. So for that reason, in the Chuvas of the Chava, Rav Shaul Yisraeli, called Chavas Binyamin, he writes that a woman is not a candidate for one of the Sheva Brachas because she's not obligated, she doesn't participate to make the minyan. It's a davar shebikdusha, requires 10 men. B'makelo is Birchu Hashem. Kal is 10 men. So therefore, she's not a candidate to recite one of the Sheva Brachas since she's not mitzarif to the minyan. Is it later, subsequent Sheva Brachas, are they considered to be part of benching, or is it a separate, obviously the chuppah, it's a separate topic, but at benching, when they come subsequently as part of the meal, are they part of benching, or are they a separate mitzvah from benching? Is it machlek in the Shulchan Aruch and the Ramah? Do you use one kais, the same kais that you can use for your birch samazin? Or as we all know, the practice of the Ramah and Ashkenazim is to use two kaises, and then you have to have some magic formula how to mix the cups. It doesn't matter, by the way, how you mix the cups. But yeah, we use two kaises for Sheva Brachas. Why? Because it's two separate mitzvahs. The Stipler and others, right, since it's two separate mitzvahs, and so the other many places can discuss the issue, does the person who's going to recite the Sheva Brachas have to have eaten at the Sheva Brachas? So if it's part of benching, he probably has to have eaten, but according to our practice, if we use two cups, even if he didn't eat there, he could recite one of the Sheva Brachas. Many people think that this is like a hidur mitzvah. I promise you, I really promise, even though it's like a Gemara and it's in Shulchan Aruch, in order to recite Sheva Brachas every meal after the wedding meal, you need Panim Chadoshes. If there's no Panim Chadoshes there, you can't recite Sheva Brachas. You can recite the last, but you can't recite any of the other, is that the one? You can recite one, but you can't recite all seven. In order to recite all seven, you need Panim Chadoshes there. All you need, though, is one new person. Panim is plural. That's because you need one person every night. But it's only one new person in order to recite Sheva Brachas. But the Stipler, and it's the Sefer Kilas Yaakov, and Masechtas Ksubas, has a Machlekes Rishonim, really two opinions in the Shulchan Aruch, is this on because we're going to recite Sheva Brachas to the person who wasn't there, he didn't hear Sheva Brachas yet, and it's an obligation upon everybody, so we're going to make it just for you. Or no, it's since you're here, you trigger, wow, it's like a new simcha, you know, a party is only as good as the people who are there. Now you're here, it's a new party, break everything out, you know, break out the champagne all over again. So is it because you increased the suda, or is it because you haven't heard the Sheva Brachas yet? So the Pisrei Tshuva writes, in the name of some Achrayim, that you can't, a woman does not qualify as one of the Panim Chadoshes. Why? So that makes sense, says the Stipler, if you assume that it's because we have to make Sheva Brachas for the Panim Chadoshes. She's not obligated in Panim Chadoshes. She's not obligated in Sheva Brachas, because it's only those who are mitzarif to the minyan. So therefore, she can't serve as a Panim Chadoshes. We're only making the Sheva Brachas for you. And she's not obligated in reciting Sheva Brachas, because she's not mitzarif to the minyan. However, the Chassam Rambam Sefer and his Kedushim and Masechtas Ksubas disagrees that a woman can constitute panim chadoshes, because he understood that it's not because it's, we're making the shabbat on her behalf, it's because she re-energizes the simcha. We're going to be marba besuda b'shvila. And an isha chashuva, you could be marba besuda b'shvila. So Rambam Sefer feels a woman can constitute panim chadoshes, and perhaps that can be relied upon. Another issue that hinges upon this, very common, is after people forget to invite panim chadoshes, you can tell it's one of my pet peeves, people don't know about panim chadoshes, but if once they forget to invite panim chadoshes, people say, oh well, there's a Jewish waiter here, Rabid, come, you'll be our panim chadoshes. So if panim chadoshes is to recite Shevar Brachos for the panim chadoshes, he didn't recite Shevar Brachos yet, so this guy didn't recite Shevar Brachos yet, we could he could constitute panim chadoshes. But if it's because we're marba besuda b'shvilai, we're not marba besuda b'shvil the waiter. So again, if you're in a pinch, you should really invite Panim Chadoshes and plan it in advance and make sure that it's someone who satisfies all of the opinions. But in a pinch, perhaps you could rely on either a woman who's a Panim Chadoshes or a waiter as one of the Panim Chadoshes. But if you're going to rely on the waiter, he should be invited to the move. It's because we're being, we have to make Shevar Brachos for him. So then he should be invited to sit down, and he should be invited to recite one of, you have to be mechabed him with one of the Shevar Brachos, and he should be invited to sit down and participate as part of the meal. The Shevar Brachos at the wedding, can they be recited on a microphone or not? So the Mishnah says in Maseches Rosh Hashanah that a kol havar is not good enough for tkiyah shofar, if you hear just an echo. Other mitzvahs and echo might be good enough. However, Rav Shlomo Zalman writes in the Mincha Shlomo, I don't think we will have dealt with this issue this year, the microphone, but Rav Shlomo Zalman writes in the Mincha Shlomo, many other achronim as well, that electronically produced sound is not even an echo. That's a garnish. That's no relationship to the original voice. It's an artificially produced sound. So that's not good to fulfill any bracha. Certainly a bracha that we're obligated in to be yoytze yidei yor chiyuv of shevar brachas, which is an obligation again upon all of us to be meshabeach HaKadosh Baruch Hu for the institutional marriage, or upon this recent marriage. So you can't fulfill your obligation by hearing it over a microphone. And if you need 10 people there, so the 10 people all have to be able to hear it directly. So that's why Rabbi Willig's opinion and Black's opinion also was you really shouldn't use a microphone for Shevar Brachos. Those who understand, less of a nuanced understanding of electricity think, well, this is just like a megaphone. No, it's not the same as a megaphone. A megaphone amplifies your voice. A microphone is an entirely different voice, an electronically produced sound. So really, I think a nice solution is just, take the microphone and put it a little bit further away so at least 10 people could hear your voice directly without the assistance of the microphone.
Well, if you're being motzi, then
everyone... At least 10 people could hear you, and at least you have a minute. Yeah, it'd be better if you wouldn't use the microphone. But many times, try move away a microphone when it's not your wedding. You'll see, someone will tackle you. So. And I was once at a wedding where Will kept moving the microphone away, and whatever. The language cannot be repeated in this context. People were not happy that the microphone kept getting moved away. The way that we count, one or two more points. The Pisrei Tshuva writes, the Siman Samar Beis of Kohen Yud Beis, that we count the 7 days of Shevar Brachos from the time of the Machlekes, you count from the time of the Chuppah, the time of the Suda, Chalkas Machlekek, and the Knesset Yechezkel, we count from the time of the Chuppah. So that's already day one. Whatever day the Chuppah was, that's day one, and then you have 6 more days to recite Shevar Brachos. And we don't count Me'es Li'es. It doesn't go based on 24-hour periods. If it happened a little bit before the Shkia, that's already day one. And then you have 6 more days. And presumably it ends at the Shkia. A lot of times you have Sunday weddings that are during the day. And then the last day of Shevar Brachos will be Shabbos. The problem is Shevar Brachos really ends at Shkia on Shabbos. So then but people want to make Shevar Brachos by Shalosh Shudis. So you have to schedule your Shevar Brachos by Shalosh Shudis so that they should finish before the Shkia. So at my wedding, that's what we did. But it's not ideal because then the people who are hosting say, well, we have a 45-minute break tomorrow. What am I going to do with all these guests? So there are poskim who are lenient, Rabbi Yaakov and Rav Vosner both write, as long as it's still Shabbos. So Shabbos is different than every other day of the week. Because of Tosefes Shabbos, you can recite Shevar Brachos all the way to Tzeis Kachah. But there are those who are trying to schedule the Shevar Brachos to end earlier. What if you make a mistake in the order of the Shevar Brachos? It says over here in the Be'er Heitev, Siman Samar Beis of Kohen Aleph, in the name of the Tshuvas HaRambam, that if you switch the order, it doesn't matter. However, the Rav Moshe writes in the Igros Moshe, you can't say Asher Yotzar before Yotzer HaAdam. Asher Yotzar is a Kadosh Baruch Hu created man. Then If you said, I'm sorry, if you said Asher Yotzer before Yotzer Adam, you already included Yotzer Adam and Asher Yotzer. So you can't go back and say Yotzer Adam. However, Shechler in the Nefesh HaRav quotes from Salavechik that if you have a Rav who was supposed to get a kibbut and now he's not going to get a kibbut, so you could let him say Yotzer Adam after Asher Yotzer. I don't know what to make of that. Again, but even if the Shevet Brachos are recited out of order, you can recite. You can go back, and they don't have to be recited in order, with that one exception. Fine, last thing, Pesachei Teshuvah writes as if cut and test in the name of the Nevi Yehuda. You only say Shevet Brachos for 7 days if one of them is their first time being married. Either he's he hasn't been married before, and she's a Basula. If they've both been married, then it's only 1 day Shevet Brachos, 3 days Issa Melacha. What if she's been married and he hasn't, or he's been married and she hasn't, 7 days Shevet Brachos. But if he's been married and she's a Ba'ula, so really there should not be 7 days Shevet Brachos. So that could lead to some sticky situations. The Pesachei Teshuvah writes of cut and test, and then they'd be Huda, but what if she's a Ba'ula Diday? Okay, so maybe again it's... otherwise you could get involved in some sick situation, something to be aware of. Okay.